This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Bush.
I'm Paul New.
And I'm Colleen Sterling. Welcome to Ask the AMPs from AOPA.
Ask the AMPs is where we try to address any and all maintenance questions that come our way. So if you have a question, reach out to us at podcasts@aopa.org.
And if you like the show, subscribe on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast.
If you'd like to get on our email list for our monthly newsletter and weekly maintenance stories, just grab your mobile device and text the word SAVVY, that's S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777, and a mail bot will ask you for your email address and add you to our list. Again, text SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777. To put yourself on our list.
One of my AMP students got his tickets. He went through the check ride, the examination, the practical, over a year ago, and then has been going back and forth with the FISDO and Oak City and Airman Standards trying to get his paper so that he could get into a program at a school.
What paper does he need?
He needs a temporary license.
When I took my AMP practical,
it expired.
It
expired.
Got a temporary.
And he never got his licenses. He took his A April of last year and his P in the summer. And then it's just been back and forth, and you can't get into the FISDO. You know, they won't answer the phone. They don't answer emails all the time. Oak City says it's the FISDO. The FISDO says it's Oak City. They both point to the examiner.
DME,
yeah. And it just goes around and around. And this poor guy finally got somebody to change some digits in a computer and issue the temporary again. And hopefully he'll get his permit.
Another temporary.
Yeah. But it was just painful. He was about to call his congressman and say, can you do something? Which is a final desperate move. I just, this not being able to go into a FISDO and talk to somebody face-to-face without an appointment is painful. And not answering the phones is equally painful.
And not necessary.
That's a 9/11 thing, and it just seems so passé. Can't we go past that now?
It's not helpful.
If I can go into a drugstore and fill a prescription talk to somebody at the DMV, why can't I go into the FAA?
Well, I know most of the FISDO inspectors are working from home still.
Why?
Well, at least I know that's true at the San Diego FISDO because I had some.
Did they stop paying rent on their offices and they don't have a desk anymore? I mean,
I don't know.
There's no reason that I can think of.
I'm sure there are no FAA people listen to this podcast.
I know. I don't want to make any enemies.
And go right ahead.
I might not know the entire story, but from the end user perspective, it's very painful. I mean, we need mechanics out there. We need pilots out there. People are having trouble scheduling check rides for the same reason that the DPs are either not working as much or there's not as many of them or they're pricing themselves out of the market. But the pipeline is getting squeezed.
Those temporaries are like good for 60 days or something?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, not that long.
No, it goes quickly. So anyway, I hope this is a local problem and not a national problem.
I wonder if that's going to affect flight instructors and stuff who have to do that every 2 years. You go through a flight instructor revalidation clinic, you get a temporary, and then you're supposed to get the real one in the mail.
Now, I will give a shout out to our local FISDO. Last year, when our IA certificates were up for renewal, one of the FISDO people came out to the airport and had lunch with all of us and signed our stuff. You know, wow. He said, hey, I'm going to be out here and I'm happy to sign.
They've always done that. It's where I'm based.
I thought that was very nice. And I would buy the guy lunch, you know, I mean, that was extra effort.
They take over the airport board conference room and we all troop into the airport to get our IAs signed off every 2 years.
Yeah,
that's great. Pre-COVID, when every now and then they would just come by our shop.
Really?
And do it on the spot. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Boy, that's good service.
Well, yeah. You know, they did an inspection while they were here. They used to really like...
In other words, a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
Our first question is from Larry, who is worried about where the rubber meets the runway. Go ahead, Larry.
Thanks, Colleen. So I, as so many people say, great fan of yours. And Mike, I'm soon to be a subscriber. So I'm really looking forward to getting some time with you. I have a Turbo Alley Turbo Normalized Bonanza 836. And due to the supply chain challenges last fall, I needed to replace my main tires. And my AMP said, hey, you can get 6-ply in, I think, 2 months, and you can get 8-ply in 2 days or something like that. And I looked in my history on that plane and logbook, and it had had 8-ply in it for a couple hundred hours in the past. My AMP said, be fine. So, of course, went and did that. And then I started analyzing and thinking and started realizing, there's a disconnect between what the POH and the TCDS permit for ply rating, very explicitly 6-ply. But when I go look at the Goodyear spec sheet, it seems to require... you know, that the six ply wouldn't be strong enough for the gross weight limit that the Turbo Alley modification gives us. The STC gives it 4,000 pounds. In other words, the POH was for 7x6 6-ply rated at 3,660 something pounds, but the STC allows me to take off land at 4,000 pounds. So again, I looked at the Goodyear spec sheet. It seemed to indicate 6-ply's limit would be about 1,900 pounds per tire, presumably 3,800 pounds static load. So, you know, you get the point of the question. Am I legal here going to my 8-ply tires? I don't have any explicit direction that says I can. But again, when I look at the Goodyear ratings, it doesn't seem like I could use 6-ply on a turbo normalized plane. So that's kind of the question. And then I got into things like, well, will it fit in the wheel well? And I thought, being used on Barons. I don't know if Barons have the exact same wheel well as an A36 or not. But again, saw it was used in the past and felt obviously comfortable enough doing it. And now I'm thinking about it. And I go in for annual in a week or two, and I'm sure it could come up.
Well, so I'm not a Bonanza guy. I don't mean that I dislike them. I just don't know that much about them. So I'm not going to give you an official answer, but I'll give you a related answer. The Cessna 210, which I know quite a bit about, calls for a 6-ply in the older, lighter aircraft. And then as the airplane got to 3,800 pounds and 4,000 pounds, they upped from a 6-ply main tire to an 8-ply main tire. You can check the diameters of a 6-ply versus an 8-ply, and you'll find they're pretty much the same. And if someone wants to go with an 8-ply, I don't see anything that says that you can't go to a heavier ply as long as the dimensions are the same. You wouldn't want to go to a lower ply for one of the reasons you're talking about, the gross weight of the airplane. So I wouldn't even hesitate. I'd put an 8-ply on there, wouldn't give me any grief at all. And I do think that the wheel wells are the same on the Bonanza versus the Baron. Now, someone else that actually studied the question can give a better answer.
I studied the question.
She raised her hand. Just so you know, she raised her hand.
I couldn't find a better answer, but I will admit in this public forum that I also went from, I increased in ply when I replaced mains on my Cardinal at the last annual. I went from 4 to 6, and I did look into it, and dimensionally, it was the same. I heard the 6-ply would be a little heavier maybe, but I didn't feel it was a significant change of weight and balance. And I did a wheel fit check in the gear just to make sure that everything was okay. I find it interesting that the STC for the gross weight increase, well, the STC isn't just for a gross weight increase. It's the Tornado Alley Turbo, and the gross weight is a result of that. But I'm surprised it doesn't address the increase in weight and the potential for, you know, the tires to be weighted out. I would suspect that they felt it wasn't an issue, and that's why it wasn't mentioned in the STC. That's all I have to say about it. Oh, maybe Mike has something to add.
The only thing I have to add is that if Larry is in violation by using a higher ply, then I am as well.
Oh, we're all guilty. All four of us are guilty. You're in good company, Larry.
In fact, what was it, 6 months ago or something? I don't know if you recall, but I wound up getting a tire down at Hawthorne.
Yeah.
And I was in exactly the same situation. The book specified ply rating for my airplane could only be procured in Texas, but they had lots of the next higher ply rating in California. So guess what I put on the airplane?
And actually, I went to the Desser site and looked for your tires, and they are completely sold out of all the models.
Yeah.
So you're right. And I'm.
Yeah.
All I can say is milk your tires, guys.
They're all on a ship in Long Beach,
probably.
Along with oil filters and a few other things.
Yeah.
Cylinders, I don't know.
That's terrible.
But I believe there's no dimensional difference that goes with the ply rating. I think the dimensions are specified by the TSO.
I was even looking at if it's inflated. It doesn't seems that it's full, those dimensions are at full inflation, I believe. So I think I'm okay on the pressure as well.
Yeah, use the TLR system for that inflation stuff. You know, you get it close.
TLR, here we go again. This is the Tennessee language requirement.
No, you know, pick a spec.
That looks about right.
That looks about right.
Yeah.
If you inflate it and they look kind of flat, not like your other ones did, then maybe you want to inflate it to a higher spec.
Yeah, I think the higher ply tires do call for higher inflation, and I always use a higher inflation in my airplane because on the theory that overinflation is a lot less bad than underinflation is.
Yeah.
You always want to err on the high side.
Err on the high side. Cute.
Oh,
that's
I didn't
good.
Mean that as a pun, but.
Thank you guys so much. Super helpful. Always appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, kudos to you for catching that and thinking through that problem. It's pretty analytic.
overthinking.
Overthinking. Well, there you go.
No, but that's good. I mean, you're involved. That's awesome.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay,
Take care. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Larry. Bye. Our next question is from Randy, who is scouring the world for the right engine. Go ahead, Randy.
I bought a Continental Iowa 360 ES engine from a guy down in Guatemala City, and he shipped it up to me. There's no logbooks. You know, the serial number says that it's from a 2006 Cirrus, and so the big question is, and it doesn't have any magnetos on it. So, you know, it has been sitting in a pretty humid environment down in Guatemala City for a little while. I don't know exactly how long. Don't have any logbooks. Can I run the thing? I mean, can I put it on an airplane and fly it, or do I have to tear it apart?
What kind of airplane are you putting it on?
Well, I'm
apparently not a Cirrus SR20, which is what the engine was intended for.
Correct. I've got a choice, either a Skymaster or a Cessna 175.
Wow. What kind of approval basis do you have for putting that engine on those airframes?
Got to get one. That's another part of the question. You know, I've got to get an approval for it.
Okay.
But you know, the first part is what I need to do to this thing. So, and to back up a little bit, the approval basis for a 175 would be, it's not the type certificated engine, but they did put Iowa 360s on the same type certificate, you know, with the T41s and the 172 XP. So that's the way I'm headed with that.
Well, one of the things that strikes me, just you know, always hits me right off the bat because I see this sometimes. There's no total time for this engine. And the FAA wants you to track total times.
No, they don't.
Well, isn't that listed in the, you got to have the total time of the airframe.
No, you do not have to keep track of time on an engine unless the engine is one that is required to be overhauled or replaced on a certain timetable, which for Part 91 operator, it isn't.
Yeah, that's always details. I lose
look at 91.
I am.
417.
Yeah.
And it says you have to keep time for components.
Only if they're tracked.
Only if they're life
required. But I was thinking, y'all go ahead. I got to look something up.
So there's absolutely no regulatory reason that a Part 91 operator can't operate an engine with unknown time.
But there's all kinds of other details that he needs to know.
You really were interested in more in the safety aspects, right?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah,
is that the basis of your question?
To be my last flight. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
but Mike, what about things like ADs and 337s and all that stuff that he has no idea if they've been complied with? I mean, the engine's not legal, right?
I'm not aware of any ADs that are based on time and service on that engine.
But how do you know? I don't know this engine, but let's say it had an oil impeller that needed to be replaced because it was the wrong material. You wouldn't know unless you opened the engine up if that AD had been complied with.
Well, he'll have the engine opened up. So.
Well, isn't that true? I mean, if somebody brings an airplane into Paul's shop, how does he know that all of the ADs for internal stuff in the engine have been complied with?
He's got maintenance records that show it. He's got a list of ADs and their compliance records. But this engine has nothing like that.
So during his teardown, to take care of that, though, before he installs it in the airplane, some A&P is going to take the engine apart, put it together, and document everything and comply with all the airworthiness directives. So that would take care of that.
Colleen, are you taking the position that if an aircraft has lost logbooks, we run into lost logbook situations all the time?
I'm only saying that he has to verify that the ADs were complied with before the engine can be signed off to be airworthy.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, if he was intending to do an overhaul, then it just will happen when he does that. But he didn't say that.
Right. I'm proposing, you know, could I just put it on the airplane and put some new mags on and, run compression checks, stuff like that?
You mean just bolt it on as is?
Yeah, that's what he wants to do.
Well, you're going to have to do a little research or the mechanic that signs off on this installation, because he or she is the poor person that has to make sure this is not a suspected unapproved part. They get all the responsibility for that installation. So they're going to have to satisfy that the airplane is airworthy, not airworthy, that this is an acceptable thing to put on the airplane. So, you know, they'll have to satisfy themselves that what they're putting on and signing off is going to be okay to put on there. So they may decide they have to do an AD research. At some point, you're going in for an annual inspection. That will have to be done.
Are either of you aware of any internal ADs on this engine that happened sometime after 2006 when the engine was presumably rolled out of the Continental factory?
I don't know. I haven't done an AD research on that engine in like 15 years.
in all likelihood, there are no such ADs.
Well, probably not. You know, what cylinders are on it? Are there any ADs on those cylinders? I mean, I don't know.
I'm assuming that's all the original stuff. I don't know that for sure, obviously.
Well, that's the thing. That's what you have to look for. You know, as the installer, that's what you don't know. So you don't know what you don't know till you look.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
From a safety standpoint, I think that I would probably be inclined to pull the lifters and take a look at the cam through the lifter bores, because that's such an easy thing to do. And I would definitely be inclined to pre-lubricate everything up the yin-yang.
Oh, yeah.
And in particular, you could pre-lube the cam through the lifter bores while the lifters are out.
Or just fill it up with oil and turn the engine upside down a few times.
and then I would go fly the engine, and if it's not making metal after 100 hours, you dodged a bullet. And if it is making metal, you tear it down. But again, I this AD thing, I think it would be worth researching whether there could possibly be any ADs that were not complied with. Because if the engine was manufactured in 2006, I think the likelihood that there are any applicable ADs, unless it, you know, had ECI cylinders put on or something like that.
All the more reason to put it on a Skymaster instead of a 175.
I just want to be a fly on the wall when he asks for that field approval. That's what I want to do. You want to do what? With what?
Well, there you go. That sounds like a solution. Better than I expected, we'd say. So.
Well, now, in the end, I may tear it down anyway. But
yeah, okay. Well, that sounds reasonable. Okay. Well, be safe, and thank you for coming on the show, Randy. It was an interesting question.
Thank you all for your comments and your discussion. It's a great show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Randy.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
Our next question is from Tom, another greedy pilot looking for all the power he's paying for. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, good afternoon, everybody, and thanks so much for having me on. I really, every month, I always look forward to the podcast. Great service you're doing for all of us. Probably a pretty easy question for you. I know previously, if you had a fixed pitch prop, RPM is an indication whether or not you're developing full power with a fixed pitch prop. And so that makes sense. I've got a 1967 182K with a Continental 0470, pretty good engine, I believe. And
oh, yeah.
At sea level, we're developing 2,600 RPM and about, and I live down in Naples. So, you know, it is near sea level. And, I'm developing about 29 inches of manifold pressure. So with a constant speed prop, the RPM's at 2,600, which is rated red line RPM. So we're developing full RPM. And if the sea level pressure's 30.00, I typically show about 29 inches of manifold pressure. So I would assume manifold pressure, since the RPM is where it should be, is an indication of whether or not I'm developing full power. And if that's the case, if I'm only getting 29 inches of manifold pressure, is that because maybe airflow inefficiencies or something like that?
That's about normal.
Yeah.
You're losing a little bit through the induction air filter. You're losing a little bit more going through the venturi of the carburetor. There's inevitably some restrictions to airflow going through there, and losing 1 inch at full powers. That sounds pretty good, actually, doesn't it, Paul?
Yeah, that's about normal. So my first question was
TLAR.
That's all right, TLAR. That looks about right. So what's the?
That's a new one. I haven't heard that one.
We use that system all the time, but only when the situation bears the most, you know, intense scrutiny. So what gauge are you reading manifold pressure on?
Well, actually, I've got the steam gauge, the manifold pressure gauge. But after listening to you guys, my partner and I, it's all your fault. my partner and I just finished, and he is an A&P, but he's an A&P by license only. So we know what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And we actually just finished installing on our own a JPI 830.
Okay.
We did have a really good A&I on the field who helped us a little bit, emphasis on a little bit, and so it's really working perfect. So to answer your question, how do I know what the manifold pressure is? We're
two
using
ways.
The steam gauge. Right, two ways, and
And they agree.
And they agree.
Wow, that's amazing.
So he does know what his manifold pressure is.
He does. I'm impressed. Because, you know, the old analog gauge, the needle width is about an inch and a half. So I just wasn't sure what you were reading me on. But, yeah, an inch below ambient pressure is actually not far off of what I typically see.
Good.
Yeah, and again, there are inevitably some losses from outside ambient going through the, first of all, the induction air filter, then making a couple of turns in the air box to go from horizontal to vertical, and then going through the carburetor, which is a restriction.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was what I was wondering.
Your manifold pressure, though, to part of your question, is that absolutely is an indicator of power capability on that engine.
It's your primary for power.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're Lena P.
Oh, that's right.
Well, half of his engine is going to be Lena Peak, so I don't know how you're going to calculate
that. But he's probably not Lena Peak when he's at full power, so hopefully
not. Hopefully not.
You know, I just want to really thank you guys. What an awesome podcast. And I appreciate the input on my question, but it's so great to have you guys as a resource and as a you know, I was a commercial pilot, but that doesn't matter here. But
we won't hold that against you.
Right. And believe me, I understand that also. But I just want to thank everybody, ladies and gentlemen, for what you guys do. It's a fantastic thing. And please keep doing the podcast for us. OK.
Happy to do it, Tom. We appreciate the call today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for your time, everybody.
Bye bye.
Our next question is from Jeff, yet another Colleen fan. I don't know why I don't have fans, but Colleen has fans. Those Cardinal people, they're always sticking together. So go ahead, Jeff, with your question.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I love your show. I had the pleasure of meeting Colleen and her husband out in California, and looking at their Cardinal before I bought mine, it helped influence my decision. And I've watched Mike and Paul on more YouTube videos, and big fan of all three of you. So I had my Cardinal ferried to El Paso, and one of the squawks was that the CHT gauge was inaccurate and never went above halfway. So I installed a GI-275 EIS while it was there, along with some other upgrades. And when we left El Paso to go home to Greenville, South Carolina, the number three CHT spiked near 500 degrees Fahrenheit on climb out. So thanks to the engine monitor, we knew that was happening. We responded and we did some adjustments to keep the temperature down. But then thinking about it later, I wonder what kind of CHTs on its way to El Paso with the old inoperative gauge. And I don't have any way of knowing what temperatures it experienced. And is there something I can inspect I should be concerned about?
You should inspect your underwear, right, Paul? I knew Paul was going to say it, so.
Now we know why he's a Colleen fan.
No. No, that would certainly get my attention, Jeff.
That's positive.
That's good. I mean, you flew it at home, right? So it's still making compression, so you're good so far. But like I said before, ignorance is bliss, right? You didn't know everything was great, and then you put the engine monitor in, and you're like, holy smokes, what's going on?
Well, I could add to that. Once I got there, it was annual, then the compressions were excellent, and I sent an oil analysis in after it arrived, and there's not going to be any cylinder head metal in the oil, I guess, but the oil analysis was great, and the compressions on the annual and everything visually looks fine.
Which Cardinal is this?
It's a 71 RG. So it's IO 360.
Oh, yep. So you're injected.
Same engine I have. Yep. And his data is on Savvy Analysis. So I took a look at the data. I also mailed it to you guys, but I guess you didn't see it.
I did not see that.
And his Garmin 275 does indeed show 498 on a CHT. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Wow. So,
man, that's really high.
Yeah, it took 2 minutes from takeoff to cross 400 degrees. He had 15 gallons per hour, which at El Paso is probably fine, a 4,000-foot airport departure. He was making good RPM, and it went for 3 minutes between 400 and 498 degrees before you could see his oh crap moment where he pulled the power and reached in the mixture. And the hands were moving in the cockpit, and he got it back down for the rest of the flight. But you can see on the very next flight, after you did the baffle fix, it's cruising along pretty good. You kept it below 400, more or less.
My recommendation would be, first of all, to stick a borescope in the cylinder and look at the piston crown. If the thing gets too hot and it starts liberating metal, the metal is not going to be coming from the cylinder head. It's going to be coming from the piston. That's the most vulnerable thing in the combustion chamber. So what we tend to see with overheated pistons is corner melting around the edges of the piston. So look at that very carefully with a borescope. Also, be alert for any kind of a pockmarked appearance on the piston crown that might be indicative of detonation. If the piston looks okay, you're probably okay. The other concern we have with very high cylinder head temperatures is the integrity of the head to barrel junction of the cylinder. But Lycoming cylinders have very, very robust head-to-barrel junctions. I can't even remember ever hearing of one coming apart. Unless the engine has ECI cylinders on it, there have been some problems with those in the head-to-barrel junction area. But if it has Lycoming cylinders on it or Superior cylinders on it, I would not be concerned about the head-to-barrel junction. But take a real good look at the piston. And if the piston looks okay, you probably dodged a bullet.
Be happy you don't have a Continental in there, because you would have exceeded the maximum temperature for sure.
Yeah, Continental's red line about 460. You didn't even pass red line, come to think of it.
Well, not on that flight, but the problem is, it was just what you were talking about before.
Yeah,
this airplane had been flying around with no cylinder head temperature instrumentation whatsoever. And so the wonder is, well, if it happened like this on this flight, I wonder what happened on the last 10 flights.
Yeah, I don't know. If you don't know what the CHT was, does it really count? It's like calories at the buffet. They don't list the calories there. It doesn't count.
The tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to hear it, right?
What did we do before engine monitors, right?
We were happy. It was a blissful existence. We didn't know why we kept changing cylinders all the time. We just knew we did. Good questions, Jeff.
Well, that was easy.
Yeah, that was. I think we might have gotten one in a row correct here. Our next question is from Ron, whose airplane is making everyone duck for cover. So welcome to the show, Ron. What's happening?
Hey, guys. Longtime listener, big fan. I own a nice 172P model, as you can see behind me here. And I've owned it for about 7 years. It's been a great airplane. But in the last year or two, every time the fuel levels are maybe probably a lot about below halfway after every flight, 2 minutes after engine shutdown, there's an incredibly loud bang that anyone in the area will hit the deck. And it no one can figure out what it is. It sounds like someone took a bat and just hit the top of the wing as hard as they could. So I've got brand new fuel caps. The vents are all open. And nobody can seem to figure out what's going on.
Well, so, okay, this is kind of fun. I don't know that I have the right answer, but I've made up something really good. So we'll see if you like this.
He doesn't want a made-up answer, Paul.
I heard that. No,
it better, better be good, Paul, because none of the rest of us have a clue here.
All right, so in your 172, you have one vent on the left side, on the left wing, correct? Right behind the strut, and that vents for both tanks. You have fuel caps that vent, but it takes about 3 hg for those to actually open. So when you're flying, the top of the wing is in basically a vacuum, or we'll say low pressure. So it takes a lot of change for that to occur. So you have to have a way to replace the fuel that you're burning with air. That's what the vent tube does. You said you checked the vent and the check valve, I assume, and that those check okay. So you have air coming into the tank. We feel pretty good about that, because one of the things that I've seen before is that you'll have a restriction in the vent and the tank will actually try to collapse because there's a vacuum. As the fuel goes out, there's not enough air coming in to replace it. So the tank will have, we call it an oil can, you know, the old oil cans that you push and click, 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 click. So if there's a vacuum on the tank and the tank partially collapses and it's a metal tank, then when you stop flying the airplane and air comes back in, it will pop back into place. It's usually not that loud. But I think yours may actually be the opposite of that. I think when you're flying, you're putting in too much air and it's inflating the tank. So the check valve lets air in the tank to let air in the vents, in the caps, let air in the tank. The only way to get air out of the tank is a little bitty, we'll call it a weep hole, in that check valve. And so that check valve has to be oriented with a hinge on top. And next to that hinge is a little bitty hole. So that, let's say you take cold fuel out of the underground tank and put it in your airplane and it's a hot day, that fuel expands. And you have to be able to let the fuel come out of the tank, or it pressurizes the tank. And that's what that little bitty weep hole is for.
Gotcha.
I'm thinking that as you're flying, you're inflating this tank. And once you land, air is trying to come out through this little bitty weep hole. And it's little bitty. It's like a number 60 drill bit hole. It's a little bitty thing. So it takes a while for your tank to deflate. And eventually when it does, it has that pop because now it's doing that oil can thing and popping back to neutral. You say this takes about 2 minutes after you shut down the engine?
Exactly 2 minutes every time.
I love that. Okay. I could be totally wrong then, but let's keep going down this path. So what I suggest is next time you go fly, shut the engine down, run out real quick and pop the cap off the top of the left tank. And if you hear a sudden rush of air coming out of the tank, you'll know what your problem is. You're pressurizing the tank. But well, now you know, you have to know why it's pressurizing the tank. When they checked your vent, did they check the position of the vent?
They is me. I do most of my...
so, but, you know, a guy. I mean,
it looks like it's in the exact right place.
How did you determine it was in the exact right place?
He used the TLR method.
The TLR method. That's a recurring theme on this show. So do you have access to a copy of the service manual?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Go in the service manual, and there's actually a couple of diagrams of the exact location for that vent tube. And it's real weird. I've seen them in all sorts of different places, but Cessna actually measures the position of some of those vent tubes down to a hundredth of an inch. Now, nobody in their right mind is going to measure it that close, but it is really important that it get in the right place. If it's too far into the slipstream, you overpressurize the tank and the tube is exposed to possible icing over. If it's hidden too far behind the strut, it doesn't pressurize the tank at all because it's in the turbulence of the strut. There also is supposed to be a foam seal around the upper strut cuff fairing. But anyway, double check the position of that vent tube. That seems to me to be the most likely thing. But definitely the next time you get out of the airplane, jump out really quick and pop a cap and see if you hear a rush of air.
Now, the problem I have with this, I'm visualizing this in my mind's eye, Paul, and he's going to shut down the engine, jump out of the airplane, go grab a ladder, start to climb up to the top of the wing so he can open the cap. And as he's getting to the top step of the ladder, the tank's going to go bang and he's going to fall off
the
ladder.
If he does that, he may need a safety belt
or something.
He might actually get to see it happen if he's quick enough.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I might mount a GoPro up there and see if I can capture it.
So do you have the steps and handles? I don't see any handle on the plane there. So you don't have the step?
I don't have the steps or handles, but I can get up there pretty quick.
Okay. You're young. You can
quicker,
do that.
Quicker than 2 minutes. That's the
quicker than two
part,
minutes.
Right?
Yeah.
But, so, Paul, be sure you're convinced it's fuel, right? It couldn't be something like a binding flap that lets go at the exact same time each time he...
Well, I mean, I can't... If a bang like that coming from a wing, there's just not much out there. You've got skins and ribs and stuff like that. So it just... Yeah, but something's got to... What's going to make a bang sound? The flaps aren't moving. And I assume... Do you raise the flaps after you land?
Yeah, they're always raised by the time it's parked, so...
Yeah.
I raise them right after the wheels are touched.
And, I mean, does he have a fuel selector where he could select one tank or the other or just do something different to verify that it doesn't happen by the time he's parked?
Yeah, he could, but popping the cap off is way more fun.
See, Paul, the other thing that concerns me is it might be the opposite. It might be that the tank it's got a vacuum in it, and the most likely reason it would have a vacuum in it would be if the vent interconnect line was somehow plugged up. Because the vent only exists on the left tank, and the vent interconnect line that runs between the left tank and the right tank over the top of the headliner there is essential for venting the right tank. So if it somehow got plugged up with something.
Vent interconnects replaced 4 years ago.
Ah, that's the problem then, right?
Yeah. So wait, now, where's the bang? Is the bang the right side or left side? I thought you said left side.
No, it's the right side.
It's the co-pilot side.
Yeah, that very well, because there's no other way for air to get in or out of the right tank. Well, it can get into the right tank through your cap. It should. So, but you said you replaced the cap.
The caps are both vented and they're both brand new.
Yeah, so that shouldn't be an issue.
And those cap vents are like emergency vents only, right? They're backup vents.
They're backup
vents. They normally don't pass anything unless there's a
right.
significant pressure differential between the inside and the outside.
I think it's about 3 hg. So on the ground, they should open pretty easily. They're just little rubber poppet things. And you said it's only with half tanks.
Well, it's more pronounced when the tanks get lower.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Whether it's a vacuum or pressure, either one, you're going to find out when you jump out and take that cap off. If you beat the oil can pop to the punch, you're going to hear the air when you pop that cap off. And so you're going to know whether you're looking for a ventilation problem, which is almost certainly the issue. You've got some ventilation issues going on with the tanks. And this, you know, this is a thing Cessna's been trying to resolve ever since they started building airplanes. All of the strutted wing airplanes have this. They ended up in 79 on the 182s with the wet wings. They went to a vent tube on each tank, and they still have troubles. Different troubles, but you know they still have troubles. I don't know why they have so much problem in the design, but it is an issue. And yours, 78s and older for pretty much everything, is heightened for exactly what Mike said. You have a connector from the right tank to the left. And that connector from the right to the left is the only source, and there's only that one line. So it is a problem. But yeah, jump and get that cap first. That'll confirm that it's a vent problem. Whether air rushes in or rushes out, either way, you'll know.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
If you're in Oshkosh, be sure and stop by the Mobile Tiki Bar.
The Mobile Tiki Bar.
We've got to stop by there.
We will be there.
We will be at Oshkosh.
You don't know what you're asking for. So. Paul is a bottomless pit when it comes to mobile tikis.
Wait, we don't even know where the Mobile Tiki Bar
is.
Well, it's mobile. So
we'll find it.
We'll find. Colleen knows how to find things.
Yeah. Okay. I have seen it before. Paul, we need to go on a little mission to find it this year.
We'll be on a mission.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, Ron, we will find you at Oshkosh. We'll be there all week. We'll find you eventually.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Keep the mustache. That's the only way we're going to know it's you.
For sure.
Right. Thanks, Ron.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you later.
So long. Our next question is from Robert, whose engine is burning oil nearly as fast as he can add it. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, thanks guys for having me on the program today. Yeah, I have a Cherokee 140, PA 28 140, and now it has begun using a lot of oil. It's just about 1 quart per hour of flight. Not only expensive, but I was just concerned that it may go downhill from there, whatever. So I didn't know. I thought I'd just ask that question. What would be your first choice of action on that kind of problem?
Well, if it wasn't a Cherokee 140, I'd say carry a couple of cases of oil in the back, but the Cherokee 140 probably can't lift that. So I think we're going to have to do something about this.
Well, do you have the back seats in it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, you don't have room for oil then.
Okay. So your mechanic suggested a top overhaul, right?
Yes.
Pulling all the cylinders off. Well, that's kind of the last thing we'd like to see done, because we don't like to see cylinders come off, and we particularly don't like to see them all come off. It's kind of a pretty risky procedure. So, you know, the first thing that we need to do is figure out, high oil consumption is always a cylinder problem, but isn't necessarily an all of the cylinders problem. So we'd like to try to figure out which cylinder or cylinders are the culprits here. And there are a couple of ways of doing that. One is to stick a borescope in and see if there's like a lot of oil puddling in one cylinder, which would maybe give you a clue that cylinder was the one that was problematic. By the way, the with all this oil consumption going on, the consumed oil has to be going somewhere. Are you seeing a lot of oil on the belly behind the breather?
No. I am not. It could be sooty under there or something. I haven't really.
Okay. Well, there are really two cases, and you need to identify which of the two cases you have. There's the most of the time, high oil consumption is caused by the crankcase getting pressurized from blow bypass the compression rings on one or more cylinders, which blows a lot of oil mist out the engine breather and winds up with oily belly syndrome. The other possibility is the oil is actually getting burned in combustion, in which case you don't see the oil on the belly, but what you see is kind of a black oily appearance on the inside of the tailpipe, as opposed to the nice dry tan appearance that we normally want to see. So by just observing the belly and the tailpipe, you should be able to determine which of these two cases that you're dealing with. Do you have an idea on that, or do you need to go take a look?
I guess I'll need to take a look. It was a heck of a bad coincidence. About a month ago, a hole came in the oil line leading to the oil cooler, and it just blew oil everywhere underneath, and it took us a lot of soap to clean that off and replace those two lines. But that was just a coincidence, I guess. I thought maybe after that happened, it was going to use less oil, but it keeps using the same amount.
Well, I stand corrected. There are three possibilities. It can either be blowing past the rings, it can be burned in combustion, or it can be leaking out. But usually when it's leaking out, it's pretty obvious because it makes a huge mess.
That did happen one day. I went around after a flight, and on the left-hand side, there was oil all over it. So it was an event all of a sudden, and then we fixed that.
Yeah.
And
you just have bad luck.
So is this the, are these the flexible oil lines to the cooler that the AD references?
I don't know about the AD, but they are red, had that red material over it.
The fire sleeve, the flexible lines. There's an AD that for the remote mounted oil coolers, you have to check those hoses. So you want to make sure that that gets done. But nevertheless, I don't think that that's really the issue. So a quart an hour is enough to coat the entire airplane. One quart, I'm telling you, you park the airplane and it'll leave a beautiful silhouette of the airplane on the hangar floor. And
not anything like that. I mean, we cleaned it from that hose problem. And I mean, I haven't actually got up under there, but I'm around it checking fuel and so forth. And I don't think there's anything like that under there.
Yeah. It seems to me like if this happened suddenly, I have had several cases where the oil return through the pistons gets clogged, and we'll often use a ring wash as a way to identify which one has done that.
Yeah. Sometimes it fixes it, but sometimes it doesn't, but at least tells you where the problem is.
Yeah. So there's, you have oil in cylinder walls, and that oil has to return back to the sump. And if that return path is blocked, then all it can do is burn the oil in that cylinder. And that can make a drastic change in the oil consumption. So you can do a ring wash where you put a concoction of liquids into the cylinder with the valves closed and bring the piston up on compression. This is like doing a compression check, but with liquid. And the oil, or excuse me, this concoction of liquids should just flow through. You should be able to pull the piston up to compression, and all this liquid just flows through and it goes down into the sump. But if you've got a blockage, it'll come up and it'll make like a hydraulic lock. You don't want to blow the cylinder head off with it, but it may clear it. Sometimes you can get it to clear. Oftentimes it doesn't. But what you've done now is you identified the one cylinder that needs to come off, maybe two, instead of all four. And no, it doesn't mean you need to do all four. You know, let's do one if we can and save an awful lot of effort and exposure.
Absolutely. Yeah, good. And in some cases, the ring wash actually will solve the problem. But if it's very, very badly sludged up, the ring wash may not be able to resolve it. But at least it will tell you which cylinders are the ones that are causing the problem. We've written up a really good detailed description on this ring wash procedure because a lot of mechanics are not familiar with it. And the URL is, read my lips here. it's bit.ly/solventflush.
Well, thanks so much, guys. Very helpful. I love the program.
Well, thank you. And I hope you solve that problem soon before that oil consumption bankrupts you.
I know that's right. I know that's right.
Yeah. Okay. You take care, Robert. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good luck, Robert.
Well, that's a wrap on another fun podcast. We know a lot more about maintenance than podcasting, so we would love to hear from you. Give us your ideas on what you'd like to hear. You can send your questions and comments to podcasts@aopa.org. Fly safely, enjoy the good weather, and have fun. We'll see you next time.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.